Welcome to Social Distance Central. Wait, that's what this is now? You're on Sportsnet 650. Here's Bit Nizar and Brendan Batchelor.
Welcome to Social Distance Central, the show with the COVID name. It's not about COVID. During the COVID era, I'm Vic Nizar. With me is not Brendan Batchelor. It is producer of the Scott Rintoul Show, Jamie Dodd. You heard him here last week as well. Jamie, what's going on?
Not too much, man. I'm happy to be back. I hope you had a very restful week off. I'm guessing you were just staying around town, though, not making any big trips with everything going on?
Yeah, no, I didn't board a plane or anything like that. It was pretty low-key. You know, I'm not a cruise person in general, so I'm not going out of my way during a pandemic to be like, you know what, it would be a great idea, jumping on a boat. Yeah, I suppose they are. Hey, you know what, I'm pro-value, so maybe I should start looking into that. Really quickly, we should touch on this as well. You know, we don't usually talk about COVID all day here on the show, but the NHL just did release some new testing numbers when it comes to them being in their phase two activities. Of course, there were some cases earlier this month on June 8th of players who were kind of outside of phase two protocol. 11 of them did test positive. New numbers coming out today. The NHL in their press release saying they had in excess of 250 players report to club training and practice facilities for optional participation in phase two. There's been in excess of 1,450 COVID tests administered to this group of players. Those tests have resulted in a total of 15 players with confirmed positive test results for COVID-19. So that's where we stand as far as the latest in testing as the NHL gets set to continue on their mission to return to play.
Yeah, it's not good news necessarily, but it's also, I don't think it's bad news. It's kind of just the expected news. You know, a positive test percentage in that range is, yeah, pretty much in line with what we've seen in other sports like the NBA, for example. So the NHL has been pretty upfront about saying, yeah, listen, in phase two, there's going to be positive tests and we just have to handle those. We have to take the right steps, quarantine the players and move forward. The really interesting testing is going to start once the players actually get into the bubble, into the hub cities, because I think this level of positive testing at this stage is not a hurdle that's, you know, insurmountable for the NHL. It's just what it is what it is. The really interesting numbers are going to be when we start moving into the next phases.
Yeah. And that in itself is an interesting spot because the players kind of have the power of moving into the next phase. And you would expect, okay, phase three is supposed to start July 10th. And you know, we've seen reports now of maybe they pushed it back a couple of days, maybe to July 13th when they start phase three. At least that's a projected start date. The players still have to vote to accelerate into those next phases. So, you know, I made the point a couple of weeks ago that I thought this was going to get a bit more contentious as we get into the latter phases when the players have more power. And we've seen that, like Artemi Panarin issued his thoughts on this whole thing. And I saw a lot of players kind of support that idea, both, you know, talking about escrow and everything. Like a lot of things need to get figured out here in these next 13, 14 days prior to moving into phase three.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of work left to be done here for the NHL. And I mean, they are coming up. They've never set firm deadlines, which I think is the right move. But even if they don't have a firm drop dead date, I mean, they're coming up on some really, really, really big decision dates here. And they're going to have to get something done. And, you know, when you're dealing with these kind of complex issues and all of the players have to be involved in a vote, there's a certain amount of time it takes just to get all of these things done. So this week is absolutely crucial for the NHL. And, you know, to your point about this is going to get contentious, and I know we want to talk about some of the nuggets of wisdom from Elliot Friedman's latest 31 thoughts, but one of the points in there that I thought was really interesting was, you know, so the NHL, they want to roll this vote all into one. So the health and safety protocols and the hub city and the return to play plan, that's all in the same vote as the CBA extension. And the consequences of that is that, you know, even the teams that aren't going to be playing, in this return to play format, they get a vote on everything. And I thought it was really interesting that one of the players that Friedman talked to pointed out, like, hey, those guys aren't taking any of the risk involved in coming back here. So of course they're going to vote yes, because it just means more money for them while, you know, they're off on an extended vacation. I don't think that's right that they get a vote on, you know, how exactly our bubble should be set up when they don't have to take any of the risk. And that's just, you know, that's something I hadn't thought of until I saw Friedman mention it. That's just another one of those examples of what you're talking about, Vic. All of those little contentious issues that still very much need to be ironed out.
It should be stated, though, right? Like, there's an economic impact that those players are going to benefit from or be impacted by whether there are games or not, right? Like, this is not just about the 4 or 5 rounds that we can play here. If we're making CBA decisions that impact years 2, 3, 4, 5 moving forward, those guys have
Yeah, but my point is, and I think what the player was getting at, is that it should be separate votes, right?
Because right, okay.
They have a stake in the CBA, whereas they're not taking the risks associated with this summer. Yeah, no, they should get a vote on the CBA, no doubt. But I'm just saying a consequence of merging those votes is that's another little point of tension between some players and other players. And, you know, that's something that has some players standing up and saying, hey, wait a minute here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We always invite your thoughts as well. 650, 650. We are going to get to Game of Takes as well. Big win for Ty Party at TParty21 on Twitter. So we'll set that up for you later on in the show. Also do want to get into something about why Canucks fans, there's a reasons why you should keep an eye on what happened in the NFL over the weekend with Cam Newton signing. So we'll get into that in a bit as well. But, you know, the big news for the NHL over the past 72 hours, it was the NHL draft lottery. What was strange about this is, okay, so if you hadn't heard, team placeholder ends up winning first overall. Ottawa slides down to 3 and 5. Detroit slides all the way up to number 4. LA ends up in number 2. This was surprising, I guess, to a lot of people, but this was an outcome you kind of should have been prepared for.
Yeah, well, no, not only should have been prepared for it. The funny thing with the draft lottery is we know exactly how likely every outcome is before we go into it, and we're still somehow shocked when an outcome happens. But it's like, well, we knew there was a chance of this. It's not coming out of nowhere. There's literally a defined set of things that can be the result of the lottery. We know exactly what the likelihood is. And yet every time, no matter what happens, there's this reaction of, oh my, how could this happen? Detroit didn't get the first overall pick, even though they had less than a 20% chance of doing so getting in. So yeah, this was always extremely likely. And I'm not trying to, you know, rain on anyone's parade, because I agree, it's super fun, it's awesome, but it shouldn't be a surprise. This was a real possibility going in.
Yeah, and what's really interesting too is, okay, obviously now we get this play-in round and 8 teams have an opportunity to get this first overall pick, 12.5%. This immediately, you know, I understand this, but I guess I'm surprised. It's just that the immediate conversation of, hey, we can lose our first round play-in series, and we got the best chance we've ever had to get first overall pick. And I'm not certain that's a good way or a logical way of looking at this. Just removing the aside, the bit of, you know, building a winning culture, all of that. I'm putting all that aside. Just because this is your best chance at getting it does not mean it's still a good chance.
No, it sure doesn't. And it's, I find the obsession with Vancouver's history of bad lottery luck to be kind of odd. And again, this kind of gets back to, I think we as a society are just not great at understanding probabilities and how they relate to each other. What happened in 1970 and what's happened in every draft lottery the Canucks have participated in since then has no bearing on what's going to happen. Like, let's all just be clear on that. And I think people know that, but when they react emotionally, they forget it. And so you get the argument that you're talking about, which is, well, Vancouver always has terrible luck, so we have to take this chance. That terrible luck has nothing to do with what's going to happen in the future. And it's definitely not a reason to, you know, go out there and root for your team to lose a chance at the Stanley Cup playoffs. For me, I look at it as just a really nice consolation prize. I want the Canucks to beat Minnesota, no doubt about it. But hey, if they lose, okay, well, you got that 12.5% chance. It's better than nothing.
Yeah, one thing that should be said, like, this is kind of win-win, because if you do win versus the Wild, okay, your playoff hopes continue, and yeah, you have a tougher opponent, but your dream of achieving and doing what this is all about, winning games, continues. If you lose, okay, yeah, you give yourself that opportunity. That's what's so exciting about this return to play scenario, is it's not defined, right? Like, the season hasn't just ended, and you kind of know where you're going, and you've got a 3% chance of it. So we're debating things that are both positive to some degree. And if you end up at 14, 15 in a lottery, you know, it's not necessarily a negative, because this is how this was supposed to work. The one other aspect of this, but that I don't necessarily appreciate when the discourse happens, is the 12.5%, or rather, there was a lot of conversation of how could you rather win one or two rounds versus having Alex Lafreniere? And the probability of maybe winning a couple of rounds versus the certainty of having a franchise player like him, like, those are kind of apples and oranges. You can't really compare the two things, because you're deliberately slanting it in a way of, look at this great reward and look at this maybe mystery box.
And this gets back to kind of my point about, just in general, we're not great at handling probability and what that means. Like, what does a 12.5% chance look like? It's not that, you know, it's well, here's a way of putting it. It's significantly less than the team that has the worst record. Significantly less than their chance of getting the first overall pick, and look how rarely that happens. And to try to, like, wrap even my head around it, like, what does a 12.5% chance look like? I did a little digging through other sports and through the NHL as well, and some kind of common occurrences that happen roughly 12.5% of the time. So I want to share some of them here. Okay. So the Anaheim Ducks this year, they had a 12% power play success rate. So that was fourth worst in the league, 12%. So that's the Canucks, if they lose the play-in round, will have roughly the same chance of drafting first overall as the Anaheim Ducks had at scoring on the power play this year. Okay, Joey Votto in the Major League Baseball last year, he walked about 12.5% of the time. Ricky Fowler made a bogey on 12.5% of the holes he played in 2019. And last one here, Kyle Korver and Kyrie Irving in the NBA, they're roughly 87.5% career free throw shooters. That means they miss about 12.5% of the time. So that's just something to, like, okay, what exactly are we talking about here with a 12.5% chance? And I'll be honest, some of those make me think it's not worth going for the first overall pick, like especially the Anaheim Ducks one. You know, their fans were like, oh man, we only score on 12% of our power plays. This is terrible. We're never going to score. That one makes me like, ooh, I don't think the Canucks should be hoping for that first overall pick. Some of the other ones is like, I don't know, Joey Votto walks a fair amount of the time. I'll take those odds. So I'm trying to give some context. I'm not saying it proves either argument one way or the other, but just so we have a better idea of what exactly 12.5% looks like.
The Korver one is stunning, man, because that guy's just a dead-eye shooter. Yeah. So it, you know, when he misses, it's a big deal.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, like, I get it. It's fun to debate the two aspects of it. I don't really understand the idea of, like, they should try to lose. Like, that's not a real thing. That's divorcing yourself from reality, right? And that's when I look at it and say, I got to learn to walk away from a conversation sometimes. Be like, well, players and coaches aren't really trying to do that, and that's not a thing. So why even have the conversation of it?
Well, and even in the most, like, extreme tank jobs that we've seen happen, you know, across sports, you want to look at, like, the trust the process 76ers in basketball. I don't think there's ever been an allegation that the players or the coaches were trying to lose. It all happens at the team building level. And even with a team like Detroit this year, which was clearly not built to maximize its wins in the 2019-2020 season, no one's suggesting that the players were out there not trying their hardest. Like, it can be, sure, it can be hard to be as competitive as you want when you're on that bad of a team for a long season, but the tanking happens when it does happen at the personnel level, at how you assemble the team. You're right, Bick. Players and coaches never go into a situation being like, how can we lose this game? Because guess what? There's no guarantee they're going to be around to see the results of drafting first overall. If you're a UFA or a restricted free agent, you're trying to make a contract this summer, or this fall now, you got to perform every game. You're not saying, oh, well, but it would be really good for the Canucks if they had Alexis Lafreniere. You don't care about that at all. You got to do what's best for you, and that's trying your best to help the team win.
Viking stats, 650, 650. I'm understanding about 12.5% of this. Keep your thoughts coming in here on Social Distance Central. Vic Nazar and Jamie Dodd joining me. And you know what's fascinating, too, is it gets leveraged on, oh, they've got to win the cup to match the reward. And if you kind of look at the math of it, the Canucks have basically 35-1 odds, according to Vegas, which implied odds would be about 3% of winning the Stanley Cup. But you can't treat it as they've got to win 19 games for that payoff, because the reality is you have to win the series, and then you get yourself another series, and then you have to win that series and earn yourself that series. So they've got to win three games versus Minnesota, and what are their odds there? About 50-50. So they move on, they play Colorado. What would their odds be there? Probably about 43-40% to win that series. So you've got to look at it as like a series of runs. And yes, the totality of it, they'll have to win 19 games. I get it. But it's kind of akin to football. Drives that start way back in the 20-yard line, there's basically a 20% chance you're going to score a touchdown. But teams aren't like, well, let's just punt it away. We've only got a 20% chance. No, you go for a first down, which, by the way, you convert 80% of the time. And so now you get yourself another set of first downs, and you continue on down to get that touchdown. So it's akin to that. You've got to treat it as the series themselves rather than the playoffs as a whole when you're having the conversation of, hey, is it worth it to go for this 3% chance of winning the Stanley Cup or versus this 12.5% in the lottery?
And I think even more than usual, this conversation gets at what do you get out of being a sports fan? What do you want to get out of being a sports fan? Like, we always, and I'm a big believer in, a season isn't worthless unless it ends with a cup, right? I know some people say that ring is the only thing that matters. I don't care if they get close. It's still a bummer of a season. I'm not like that. I'm there for the journey, but this year, especially, like, I don't know about you, but I want to watch some hockey. I desperately want to watch some hockey. And, even if the Canucks get bounced in the second round of the playoffs, well, that means they get to play, 10, 15 more meaningful games. That's what I want to see more than anything else. Even setting aside, oh, is that good for the long-term growth of the team? How much does that experience count? Those are all interesting questions. But, like, as a fan, I want to watch this team play high-stakes hockey because we've been deprived of that for so long now, and that's something I want in my life. When they made the Tyler Toffoli deal, I immediately was like, man, I hope this team makes the playoffs because I want to see what this team looks like with Brock Besser and Tyler Toffoli in the lineup. Now we have a chance to see that. I don't want it to be cut short at five games just because it gives them another roll of the dice at a really good young player. I want to watch this hockey team compete right now.
Really interesting, actually, just happening right now. It looks like in the MLB, a bunch of players are opting out to come back to play. So this will be something we can keep an eye on. If this translates to the NBA, if this translates to the NHL, what happens with that? So again, I just wanted to put that news out there. A handful of guys have already started to say that they are not coming back in Major League Baseball. So just keep a heads up when we get to phase three. And as players start to vote on this return to play. It's Bick Nazar, Jamie Dodd. We want to set up Game of Takes. So big win last week for Ty Party, who sits atop the composite throne now for you Canucks fans. So how you take him down now? We're going to pose this to you. He chose the topic. Who is the Canucks MVP for this season? Now, we'll post that on Twitter shortly, at Sportsnet650. You can also enter from the text message inbox, 650-650. What you know, like we've had so many conversations about this, whether it's the Quinn Hughes debate, JT Miller because of his emergence this year, Elias Pettersson, Jake DeMarcus. There's a lot of candidates. But for me, it lands on the shoulders of Jacob Markstrom. Because I think it's a different conversation of best player, who to me was Elias Pettersson this year, but most valuable. Because I look at valuable is who had the biggest direct impact on winning. And we know that goaltenders have that burden traditionally themselves, but given the workload that Jacob Markstrom had to face and the degree of difficulty, we've spoken to Steven Valiquette as well of how tough it is, top 10 in so many different metrics, of, you know, unstable environments for goaltending, and Jacob Markstrom's thrived in it. So to me, I look at that and I say, okay, he's the MVP because he had the biggest impact on winning.
I mean, it's a very compelling argument. And my overall take on the Canucks MVP discussion is that I'm not going to say there's no wrong answers. Obviously, there are some wrong answers. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of Pettersson versus Markstrom, which is where I think a lot of fans land, I'm not going to get too heated no matter which side you take. I know this is sports radio and I'm supposed to be screaming at you, Bick, because you chose Markstrom and I'm going to say Pettersson. But like, I mean, you described it. Markstrom was really, really good and he had a huge role on the Canucks winning as many games as they did. So it's tough to get too worked up about that. You know, for me, I look at Pettersson and I kind of default to best player on the team. That most talented player who performed the best, whatever you want to call it, that's who's going to get my MVP, unless there's really exceptional circumstances, unless they had a down year, unless somebody else stepped up in a big way. And I know Markstrom did step up in a big way, but I still just look at what Pettersson does game in, game out, shift in, shift out. The way he changes what that team looks like. He drives play. He scores. He's a catalyst on the power play. He's really effective defensively. I know the knock on him is, well, can you give him credit as a center when he doesn't necessarily take draws? I still think he plays an important role in the middle of the ice for the team. So I look at the totality of what Pettersson brings. He is my pick. But again, I'm not going to yell at you for taking Markstrom. He was incredibly valuable to the Canucks this year.
Similar to what we were talking about with this play-in round, right? It's win-win. You're choosing between two very good options, but you still got to choose 650, 650, or at Sportsnet 650 to get your take in. If you want to take on at Tea Party 21, the current leader on the composite throne for Game of Takes. You mentioned the MVP. We're talking about it. I want to talk about another MVP. We'll do this after the break, but the 2015 NFL MVP, Cam Newton, signs a one-year deal in New England. The way this has all gone down is a reason why Canucks fans should kind of keep an eye on how this all transpired and how it can relate to this Canucks offseason. We'll get into that coming up here on Social Distance Central on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
I put the new 4Gs on the G. I trap into the bloody bottoms is underneath. Cause I might got it out the streets. I keep 100 racks inside my G. I remember hitting them all with a whole.
Welcome back to Social Distance Central. Spick and Star, Jamie Dodd, home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650, on a gorgeous Monday. If you missed it over the weekend, maybe you were just under a rock. The NHL Draft Lottery went over the weekend, and good news for the Vancouver Canucks because... I guess their team placeholder, won the lottery, ending up at first overall. So they have a 12.5% chance of landing first pick. Should they lose and be one of the seven other teams that lose their play-in round? Just overall, Jamie, your thoughts of how that lottery went, and you know, I guess we look at who won, who lost the whole lottery process.
Yeah, I look at it as, first of all, probably a win overall for the league, just in terms of the interest generated. And it helped that they got, you know, arguably the funniest and most interesting possible result and the weirdest possible result. And I know it has set off another surge of, oh my goodness, the lottery is so unfair. We have to change it. This is brutal. How did Detroit fall all the way to number four? And again, like, it comes down to your expectations. This is, the lottery is working the way the league wants it to work. The league doesn't want the worst team to be almost guaranteed the best pick. We've seen that things can get ugly when that's the case. As we all know, you know, going back to the great Arizona and Buffalo tankathon, mm-hmm. that the league was really not happy with it. And they made changes for a reason. So I think it's kind of odd every time that a team in the, you know, 8 or 9 range jumps up to pick first overall, there's this great hue and cry about it. But I mean, that's the way the system is designed. We knew it was designed that way. And listen, if the NHL reversed course, I wouldn't have a huge problem with it, but I just don't get why the result of any one lottery is going to force you to change your mind. You know what the system is. You don't need to base, you know, your reaction just based on this one event. You have all the information you need before you have the actual drawing of the balls.
Yeah, and like, this is the system working. Like, exactly. Much in the same way, you know, these COVID tests are going right now. Like, this is the process working. The NHL has prioritized anti-tanking. So whether you agree or disagree that the distribution of talent, of how players come into the league, should go to the lower teams, the way this lottery is designed is do not tank because your reward is minimal for doing so. So this is their version of the lottery working. Now, if you have an issue with it, you have got a philosophical way of how the NHL does the lottery. You don't have a care of what these results look like. You just have overall issues with it. So your complaints are regenerative. They will come back every single year. But if you want to incentivize winning, which is what the league is trying to do, this is how it looks. And to me, I say, like, kudos to them for doing it this way. This is kind of how it should be if you want to have a lottery system. It was, you know, kind of gimmicky to say, oh, you could only slide one spot before. And, you know, to have a true lottery system, to have there be a reward now, is massive for the NHL, because it allows themselves to have competitive games throughout the season.
It does. And, you know, if anything, if I was going to tweak the lottery, I would probably make it more punitive to the worst teams, give them less of a chance to, you know, draft the best overall player in the draft, because ideally then that would have the result of, you know, more teams going into the year with the goal of actually winning games. And that's what the NHL wants. So I think it would be a total mistake to backtrack and say, look at a couple of these results and say, okay, we've really got to reward these awful teams. Like, in general, I just don't believe that's the way the sports, the league should be governed, is, well, you were really bad, so here's a nice little pick me up. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me. I think the system they have right now is kind of a decent middle ground where, yeah, I know the NHL thinks parity is important too, so they want to help out those kind of, you know, bottom tier teams, but they don't want to hand it to them on a silver platter. I think that's probably a decent compromise, and I just don't see any reason to go back to the old system. And it's the fact that the idea that we're supposed to feel so sorry for Detroit, I just don't get it.
Oh yeah, as far as feeling sorry for teams, I've kind of reversed course on this, because at first I kind of did feel sorry for Ottawa and Detroit to some degree. But Ottawa especially, this is like, I'm going to make a lottery reference in relation to the lottery.
Yes.
This is like, if you have 7 of the 7 numbers and you won a jackpot, man, that's awesome. But you didn't get the bonus number. So yep. You didn't win the grand jackpot, and it probably just got pushed over to next week's lottery draw. But Ottawa's walking away with 2 top 5 picks. Let's be a little less sympathetic for them. They are still going to walk away with 2 real pillars for their organization. We know what number 5 overall can do to an organization. So it's not as if they are big losers here. They are still coming out major winners, especially when you consider, you know, one of them was that trade, and San Jose is the third team that the third overall pick. So they won big here. So I don't want to see a lot of sympathy for the Ottawa Senators here in this scenario. I understand the ball should have came a certain way, and they should, you know, we all wanted to see them have 1 and 2, but they did okay in all of this.
It's the kind of thing where anytime you're drafting third and fifth overall, it almost doesn't matter like how it happened. It's like you're a winner. That's really good. That's really good for your team that you're drafting third and fifth overall. So yeah, it's hard to feel too much sympathy. And as you alluded to, the trade with San Jose, if you told the Senators when that deal went down, remember San Jose went on a deep playoff run mm-hmm. just the year before. If you said, hey, that pick is going to be third overall next year, yeah, I think they'd be pretty happy with that. So just because at times it was trending to maybe to be slightly better. I mean, you look at where they bought that pick. I mean, talk about buying low, right? They got an incredible deal on it, and it worked out almost literally as well as it could have for them. So it's a home run for the Senators. When you just take a step back and look at the larger context, this is still an incredible result for them.
Yeah. I want to get to some of your texts as well before I get to my little Cam Newton spiel. Dave in North Burnaby, because we were talking about, you know, the lottery odds and Canuck motivations to some degree. Dave in North Burnaby chimes in 650. Getting first overall would mean Toffoli would be much less important either in bargaining or losing to free agency. Just a thought. So, you know, you replace a top six guy in Lafreniere for Tyler Toffoli. Here's the thing, is having cheap, young, elite talent should offer you flexibility to try to retain those players, and maybe you try to make up the money elsewhere on the roster. That's what it does too, because now you injected this great player, you should be wanting to retain great players as well to play alongside with them to accelerate how your overall goal. Your overall goal is to win games. Just because you get one great player in doesn't mean you should let another one walk away. It takes a lot of players to get this right.
And I mean, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, and I understand yes. that, but let's say hypothetically the Canucks are in a position to draft Alexis Lafreniere. Well, I don't think if that happens, that's not like another step in the rebuild. That's the, we got to go right now signal, because all of a sudden you've got this incredible crop of young players who are cheap for a very limited amount of time. And we know already that Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes are going to get big raises in the not too distant future. Alexis Lafreniere, if he is anything like we all expect him to be in the NHL, he will get a very big second contract as well. So again, I understand we're getting very far ahead of ourselves, but I think it's a good point you make, Bick. It's not, you don't slot Alexis Lafreniere in and think, okay, and he's going to help us win 5 years down the road. You draft him and it's like, how can we make this team competitive next year? Because that's the time frame they'd be working on.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, the name I've mentioned in the past of, if you want to try to free up some money, because you know there's a chance he gets a decent raise coming up this season, for next season, sorry, it is Jake Virtanen's name. And we've used his name for Game of Takes before. He's obviously a polarizing topic at times. And if you missed it in 31 Thoughts, Elliot Friedman's blog that went up over the weekend, because he was talking about a number of different things, including signing bonuses. We'll touch on that with Louis Erickson in just a moment. But one thought from Elliot Friedman was, one question still being asked is, what is going to be the salary arbitration walkaway number? With a tight cap, this is going to be huge. And one of the fears I think a lot of people have had that have been in the camp of, you kind of have to move away from Virtanen, is that RFA number, if it goes to arbitration, you know, you could make a decent case for Jake Virtanen that he gets a significant raise off of his $1.25 million. So, like, you know, we keep talking about things that have to get worked out here in these next 13 days and leading into the CBA talk. This is one of those things.
Yeah, it's, again, and it seems like we keep making this point, but it's true, is that there's so much, you know, when the NHL announced that they had this return to play format, there was so much celebration, and understandably so, because it was the first like tangible progress mm-hmm. towards getting hockey back. But
people inside the league weren't celebrating. They're
yeah,
like,
exactly.
Oh, that's so much
it's
work
like,
to
oh, actually, hold on. There's still tons of yes. work left to do. And we're seeing that now. And that's just another one of those details where, you know, if you had asked me last week, like, list all of the issues that still need to get ironed out, I mean, that wouldn't have been in my top 50. Because I'm not a capologist. I don't pour through every item in the CBA to see all of these little things that have to get worked out. But that's one that's really important, especially to a team, like you said, like the Vancouver Canucks, that have a couple of fairly high-profile RFAs coming up this year. Not just Jake Virtanen,
yeah,
but another guy we've talked about a lot, Troy Stetcher.
For sure. And if it gets to a spot where teams are feeling restricted, I mean, not to make play on the words of restricted free agency, but if teams are, you know, in a tough spot, that's why we've had this conversation of exploring, because I think you have to be cognizant of the idea that these guys could get bigger raises than I think people are comfortable with. And, you know, when we had the conversation on Game It Takes, some people were comfortable giving 3 years over the course of $3-4 billion. If that's where you feel, okay, maybe you're not too concerned of what an RFA or arbitration ruling looks like. But, you know, $3 million is a lot of money for considering when we're talking about, there's a lot of complaints for people of not enough production from that middle to bottom six. And if that's where you're slotting, like, again, that's how you can free up some cash. And the Troy Stetcher one's also an important conversation because, you know, with Tanev and Stetcher, one of them's going to have to potentially be in a top four role next year, or, you know, are both of them back or neither of them back. He could get a big raise too, because he's eaten some minutes and there's value for right-handed D-men. The price bump for him could also be really interesting. The other note we wanted to touch on, though, from Elliot Friedman's blog, 31 Thoughts, we can check out now at sportsnet.ca, because we are actually just days away from Canada Day, also free agency day. And usually when signing bonuses get paid out. And there was a note in, a thought rather, in Elliot's 31 Thoughts, that signing bonuses are kind of expected to get payout as of right now. Now, there may be a deferral to next season, but this is still another thing that people look at. And especially in this market, when we know Louis Erickson is days away from cashing another $3 million check, which then remains $5 million on the rest of his salary for the next 2 years. How this gets paid out and how this plays out is going to be looked at very closely.
And along not just the signing bonus issue, but Friedman also mentioned the concept of deferring parts of other parts of the salary over a span of years. And the interesting thing is, you know, Friedman's as plugged in as anyone, and the people he's talking to, they're not even sure exactly what's going to happen. Yep. And I think that just illustrates how much uncertainty there is left, that even the people who are the most dialed in and who probably have firsthand knowledge of these negotiations are still like, ooh, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen there. It does seem like the NHL, they're trying to walk a very, very fine tightrope here by keeping the cap flat without, you know, hitting the players over the head with escrow, also capping escrow. And it does seem to me like another shoe that might have to fall at some point is an amnesty buyout in some form, because that's just a really tough needle to thread. Otherwise, if you're not rolling any salaries back, but you're keeping the flat cap and the cap flat, and you're also capping escrow, like, it kind of feels like something's going to have to give in these negotiations eventually.
And the reason, like, just seeing the deferral kind of notice of, okay, maybe we can kick the signing bonus money down the road, is for Canucks fans, they've looked at this summer of, okay, you pay out that $3 million. Can you make life difficult for Luke Erickson, for lack of a better term, and say, is $5 million really worth the next 2 years of being in Utica? Can you start doing that? Well, if $5 million becomes $8 million and the signing bonus gets deferred from this July to later on in the year, or who knows when, well, then you're probably going to see Louis Erickson around for a significantly longer period of time. This becomes interesting. Well, then it's financially worthwhile for him.
Yeah, and also for the team, if the cap hit is spread out like longer, then it almost becomes more like a buyout, you know? And it's like, we get a little bit off the books, but not that much. And is it better just to keep him around at that point?
For sure. I just wanted to get that in. Just some of the latest. You can check it all out, by the way, at sportsnet.ca, Elliot Friedman's 31 Thoughts. Okay, so the big news over the weekend kind of broke Twitter yesterday. In the NFL, 2015 MVP Cam Newton, he signs a one-year deal with the New England Patriots. Now, what happened here is basically the quarterback market dried up. For whatever reason, there was a significant lack of interest from 31 teams, and so he lands in New England with a chance to redeem his career and his own market value. Adam Schefter reporting today that New England's the only team that really offered him a contract. Cleveland kind of spoke to him, but outside of that, no interest. And, you know, Jamie, you and I have had this talk of teams in the NFL right now, whether we agree with them or not, a lot of them have quarterback plans, right? So some of them might have inferior quarterbacks, or they're just kind of part of their youthful development curve, but a lot of teams have QB plans. And so when three guys, Jameis Winston, Cam Newton, Andy Dalton, all guys who've had success in this league in the NFL, all go to free agency, the markets weren't really there for them. Jameis Winston ends up as a backup in New Orleans, Andy Dalton in Dallas, and Cam Newton now gets a starting role in New England. There was only so many spots for these guys to end up. I guess Cam's the big winner, but he's kind of a loser because he, you know, probably doesn't get the contract that he wanted.
Well, no kidding. Yeah. And I mean, it's been floating around Twitter. There are some of the names of quarterbacks who are making significantly more than Cam Newton and, you know, Chase Daniels out there. I think AJ McCarron still. So it's pretty shocking to see him accept that contract. You know, it's interesting to see also how much buyer's remorse some of the early movers in the QB market must be feeling right now. Like the Bears with Nick Foles, the Raiders with Marcus Mariota. You know, they're paying way more in terms of assets and salary to go get those guys when Cam Newton was just sitting there. And I think the difference between Cam and Jameis Winston and Andy Dalton is he wasn't going to go somewhere where he didn't have at least a chance to win the starting job. And obviously Andy Dalton and Jameis Winston ended up having to do that. They said, okay, whatever, I'll go be a backup somewhere. Maybe there's an injury. Maybe I get my shot. I can try again later, but I'm going to accept being a backup. And I doubt Cam was willing to do that. And then there's also the question with his health, but the clear winning situation for him, I think, was New England, because, you know, as much as we hear, oh, the Patriots really love Jarrett Stidham, I mean, Cam is going to get every chance in the world to be the starting quarterback there. And hey, go get to play with Bill Belichick with a still very, very talented defense. That's a dream situation in terms of reestablishing your value as a quarterback.
What's important that you mentioned is motivation to a start and also get an opportunity to win, right?
Yeah.
The lesson here for Canucks fans to take away from this whole scenario is basically musical chairs, that there was a market, a very, very small market that was flooded with talent that teams could pick and choose, whether rightly or wrongly, but teams could pick and choose who they wanted to contact. And arguably the best guy in that barely got contacted. And he kind of had to choose a good landing spot, albeit, but he kind of had to choose what was given to him. When you look at the marketplace right now in the NHL for goaltenders coming into this season, whether we agree across the league that this team has a plan or a good plan or not, a lot of teams actually have plans. And Jacob Markstrom is becoming a free agent. There's a lot of concern. I was doing a podcast yesterday. A lot of concern that, you know, if Jacob Markstrom is going to get significantly over $6 million, well, maybe we just walk away. And I think the concern I have when I hear those types of numbers is I'm not sure it matches the actual market for Jacob Markstrom. Because look around. How many teams really need goaltenders next year? It's basically Chicago, maybe Carolina, maybe Calgary, but they seem committed to David Riddick, and you're basically going to be a 1B there or a 1A kind of scenario. And then Ottawa and Detroit, but are they in a position where they're ready to give out term to a 30-plus-year-old goaltender? Or are they still trying to kick the can down the road of, let's build up the entire system, and then when we're ready to go, we're ready to go? So it basically comes down to three teams. And then look at the flood of goaltenders that are coming into the market, both at the high end with Leonard, Holtby, Markstrom, Crawford, or kind of your 1B, 1A type guys of Hudobin, Grice, Craig Anderson, if you want to throw him in there. So when I hear these numbers, I kind of feel like it's going to be musical chairs for the very same reason Cam Newton found himself kind of taking a league minimum deal. Again, a good landing spot, but not the contract he wanted. Whereas if the Canucks are playing hardball with Jacob Markstrom right now, it's kind of the right tack to take. Where are you willing to go to maximize your contractual value? Are you really going to go to Ottawa and Detroit? And is Chicago going to retain Corey Crawford and try to bring in a lesser guy like a Hudobin or something like that? So the leverage the Canucks can apply in this scenario is actually really high, and I don't think they need to jump into the water with like, oh, man, we think your talent is six $6.5 million. We're going to do that right now. I think this is going to be a bit of a drawn-out process, and the number that makes the most sense, I think, is significantly lower than I think what Canucks fans fear right now.
Yes, I agree, and especially a couple of points. One, that the Canucks have leverage, and that's it also because, you know, they don't have to, let's say they let Markstrom walk, they don't necessarily have to dip into the high-end goalie free agent market to complete their goalie tandem because they have Thatcher Demko there. So they have a plausible backup scenario if they do decide to let Jacob Markstrom walk. And then the other thing is, you know, you just go through the teams you mentioned that might be players for a goalie. And like Carolina, I mean, we know how analytically minded that front office is. I don't see them splashing out big bucks, the kind of money it would take to lure Jacob Markstrom away from the Canucks. Even the Blackhawks, you know, they're not necessarily in like a terrible salary cap position, but they've got some big money left on their books for significant periods of time. Do they want to add another big contract at the goalie position? And then just the impact of COVID and the flat salary cap as well. So, you know, again, taking Chicago, Corey Crawford's 35. He's going to be a UFA. With a flat salary cap, is he going to get a big payday somewhere? Or does he look around and say, hey, you know what, Chicago, this has been a really good partnership for both of us. I'm 35. I'm willing to take a short-term deal here just to get a little bit of security and a little bit of familiarity in a very, very strange and uncertain time. So all of a sudden, that could be a team that's off the board. And with the league in general having less cap space, I think the easiest position to look at and say, you know what, we can get by there with spending less is goalie. I don't think teams are going to be lining up to hand out big goalie contracts this year when they have less cap space than ever before to work with. So all of those factors that we're talking about, they all add up to give the Canucks the upper hand in these negotiations with Markstrom.
Yeah, and like some teams are, I guess, in the immediate, like maybe a Minnesota, they got Devan Dubnyk for 1 year. Maybe they want to invest for multiple years if they're so focused on winning, which by all accounts they seem to be. But they've got some interesting prospects coming up. So the plans around the league are pretty deep. And not to mention, what about the secondary goalie market of, you know, we got this Seattle expansion draft looming over everything. What's New York going to do in goal with their guys? What is Vancouver going to do with Demko? If you add another goalie into the market, it's just going to be harder and harder for these teams to figure out and more specifically choose an individual guy when there's so many guys available, and that's going to hurt the goalies, their own financial value. So I just wanted to lay that out there. Just be considerate of the idea that the number of spots available for goalies is a lot less than I think people realize. And that probably plays into the hands of the Vancouver Canucks in regards to the Jacob Markstrom contract. Jamie, you're sticking around for the rest of the day. Randy Janda will join you in just a couple of minutes on Reach Deep. Sam Cosentino on the way. Also, Chris Johnston, our Sportsnet NHL insider, coming up on Reach Deep on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.